For the main event. All right, we're very privileged this morning. So our speaker this morning is Gary Francione, who is Distinguished Professor of Law at Rutgers University in Newark. He also has a whole bunch of other distinguished titles, which I won't have time to list. His work has focused on three issues: the property status of animals, the differences between animal rights and animal welfare, and a theory of animal rights based on sentience alone rather than any other cognitive characteristics. Gary is a pioneer of the abolitionist theory of animal rights, arguing that animal welfare regulation is theoretically and practically unsound, serving only to prolong the status of animals as property by making the public comfortable about using them. He rejects all forms of violence, arguing that the animal rights movement is the logical progression from the peace movement. Gary is the author or co-author of several books about animal rights, starting with Animals, Property, and the Law in 1995, following with the celebrated Rain Without Thunder in 1996, then Animals as Persons in 2008, and the Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Regulation in 2010. He has also written papers on copyright and patent law and science. I first had the pleasure of meeting Gary in 1985 during the 1985 PETA sit-in at the National Institutes of Health. As PETA's counsel and chief negotiator with the NIH hierarchy, Gary was successful in shutting off funding for the University of Pennsylvania's obscene head-bashing experiments on primates. His negotiating skills persist to this day, which is how he got a 40-minute plenary, where most other speakers are lucky to get 12 minutes. Gary will speak for 40 minutes. I may have a few quick comments, and then we'll open the forum to all of you for questions and answers. And if we're unable to get to some of you, you'll have another chance in discussing things with Gary this afternoon at 12:30 during his debate with Bruce Friedrich, I think in this room, okay? So, finally, as Gary's many fans know, he has very strong views about certain animal rights organizations or other animal organizations and tactics, which are not necessarily shared by us or some of you. But I can promise you that the presentation will be entertaining, and most important, it will be thought-provoking. And so without further ado, please help me welcome my good friend, Gary Francione.
Wow, there's a lot of you out there. Okay, good morning. I want to say before I start, as Alex just said, I do have strong views about just about everything, and I. I say I do have strong views about the issues I'm going to talk about, and I don't want anybody to. What? Oh, what did I do? What did I do? I don't want anybody, I want it to be clear, I'm not challenging anyone's integrity. I am critical. I think the animal movement is in horrible shape. I think the whole reformist movement, the whole happy exploitation movement is a disaster, and it's just getting larger and larger and more pervasive, and I think it's just a disaster. But I certainly believe that the people who are doing it, I'm not questioning their sincerity at all. I do sincerely believe they are wrong, and I want to talk about why. I call it the abolitionist approach. Why do I call it the abolitionist approach? I used to call it just animal rights. But now animal rights has become a meaningless expression. As a matter of fact, this is my book from 2010 that I co-wrote with Professor Robert Garner, The Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Regulation. This is a quote from Randy Strauss, who's president of Strauss Veal and Lamb, a large American meat processor. And he wants to make the production of veal more humane so that people can fully enjoy veal. This is a quote. Fully enjoy veal with the satisfaction of knowing that veal calves are raised in a humane manner. Strauss argues animal rights are important. Now, again, my view is when a veal producer is talking about animal rights, the notion has lost its meaning, and it's time to use different language. So I talk about the abolitionist approach, but I talk about it's the abolitionist approach to animal rights. Where's my little, okay, it's here. I have a PowerPoint. This is the first PowerPoint presentation. I've been teaching for 30 years. I have never, you know, I go into large lecture rooms and I lecture to law students, and when I get, this is the first time I've ever done a PowerPoint presentation. So it will either be very successful or an incredible disaster. We'll figure, you'll be the judge of that. In any event, so I call it the abolitionist approach to animal rights. There are some people who maintain, they say, you know, Gary, you know, there's no distinction between rights and welfare. As a matter of fact, someone recently called it a myth that there's a difference, that there's a conflict between the rights and the welfare approach. And what I hope to persuade you of this morning is that is just plain wrong. I want to make 4 points. The first point I want to make, let's see, okay. Ah, there we go. Okay. The first point, it's working, Sarah, it's working. I said I prepared a PowerPoint presentation. I didn't say I didn't have help. And it's a pretty simple one, so it's pathetic that I needed help. However, all sentient beings are equal for the purpose of not being used exclusively as a resource. Look, there are many different theories of animal ethics, but all of them, with the exception of what I'm trying to do, all of them take the position that animal suffering matters. Animals matter morally, but animal life does not matter. That animal life is not as morally valuable as human life. And that leads into two directions. First, it gets us to focus. It gets the movement to focus on treatment issues and not use issues, and paves the way for things like compassionate consumption, being a conscientious omnivore, promoting organizations like Whole Foods or partnering with organizations like McDonald's and things like that, which I maintain could never happen if we took animal life seriously. We take animal suffering seriously, but we don't take killing seriously. This also leads in the direction of focusing on cognitive characteristics. That is, if animals are close to us or perceived to have human-like intelligence, they matter more. But the further they are away from human-like intelligence, the less they matter morally. So, great non-human great apes, they matter. They're close to us. Elephants, they matter. Dolphins, they matter. What about chickens? Not so much. What about fish? Not so much. Okay? What about cows and pigs? Well, they're sort of in between. Now, my view is cognition doesn't matter. As long as you're sentient, if you are a sentient being, whether you're a fish, whether you're an elephant, or whether you're a human, you are all equal. We are all equal for the purpose of not being used as exclusively as a resource, okay? This is, you know, look, cognition matters. Let's imagine you have a very smart person and you have somebody who's mentally disabled. Is cognition, is the difference in intelligence morally relevant? Well, it may be for some purposes if the question is, you know, you've got a scholarship, and do you give it to the person who's an able student, or do you give it to the person who is mentally disabled? Well, they're not similarly situated. So if you ask for purposes of who should get the scholarship, cognition matters. But if the question is, who do we use as an unconsenting subject as a in a biomedical experiment? Who do we use in a, you know, who do we take the organs out of to save others? Who do we enslave? The answer is they're both equal. There is no difference. Cognition in that case doesn't matter. So cognition may be used, may be relevant, morally relevant for certain purposes, but for the key purpose of whether or not you can be used exclusively as a resource, I maintain it's thoroughly irrelevant. Now, let me give you a little history. I will try not to bore you terribly, but we need to understand how we got here, because it's important to understand how we got here. Before the 19th century, animals were regarded as things. They were completely outside of the moral and the legal community. Is this mine? Thank you. They were completely outside the moral and legal community. They simply didn't matter. They were things. Now, there were different reasons that were given. There are people like Descartes who said that animals don't have any sort of minds whatsoever, so they don't have any interest. There's nothing that they prefer or desire or want. They're like, you know, he called them machines. They were automatons. They were automatons made by God, whereas machines are made by humans. But he thought, he did. They didn't have anesthesia when Descartes was working, and in the 16th century. And so when he would nail dogs to boards and cut them open, and when people said, you know, but they are screaming, he would say, they're not screaming, they're like machines which don't have oil. There's nothing going on there. There is no cognition. Now, he's somewhat unusual in the history of philosophy. By and large, most people acknowledge that animals had interest, that is, there were things that they preferred or desired or wanted, but that we could treat them as if they were things that we could ignore because they were spiritual inferiors, they were not made in the image of God as we are supposedly made in the image of God, or they were cognitive inferiors. They couldn't reason, they couldn't use abstract thought, they couldn't use symbolic communication. Okay? Now, this changes dramatically in the 19th century as a result of progressive social thinking that sort of starts towards the end of the 18th century. People like Jeremy Bentham, John Stuart Mill, Mary Wollstonecraft, people like that who were talking about race-based slavery, talking about women's rights, things of that nature. All of a sudden, animals get on the radar screen, as it were, and you have, let's see if this works now, okay. Yes, and you have Jeremy Bentham argued that a full-grown horse or dog is more rational and more able to communicate than a human infant. But the question is not, can they reason, nor can they talk, but can they suffer? So what Jeremy Bentham says is, look, you know, yeah, they may be mentally different from us. They may not be able to reason. They may not the way we do. I mean, they can obviously reason, but they may not have human-like reasoning or human-like, the ability to use abstract thinking the way humans do. However, they are able to suffer, and that's all that matters for them to matter. Now, let me see. Okay. However, you want to say, oh, that's great, Jeremy Bentham. Did he become a vegan? Well, if you've ever seen pictures of Jeremy Bentham, you know he didn't get that body by eating broccoli. He ate a lot of animal foods, and he continued to eat a lot of animal foods until he died. So you say, well, how does this work? Why didn't he advocate the abolition of animal exploitation, as he did advocate the abolition of human slavery? Bentham, there are two reasons, basically. Bentham and people who agreed with Bentham made a distinction. They said, look, animals aren't self-aware. They don't care that we use them. They only care about how we use them. The cow doesn't care that we eat her. She cares about how we treat her and how we kill her. That's what she cares about. She doesn't care about whether we eat her. As long as we treat her well and as long as we slaughter her humanely, she doesn't care. Then you have, let me see, this is, if we kill and eat them, we are better for it, they are never the worst, they have none of those long protracted anticipations of future misery, which we have. Basically, they're not self-aware. They don't sit around saying, hey, look, you know, I'm getting older, I'm going to die one of these days, you know, it's really horrible, blah, blah, blah. You know, they don't think that way because they don't have a sense of self-awareness, all right? The death that they suffer in our hands commonly is always maybe a speedier, and by that means a less painful one, that which would await them in the inevitable course of nature. We should be the worse for their living, and they're never the worse for being dead. So we don't harm them when we kill them. Okay? Now, as crazy as you might think that sounds, that idea exists right now. It's an animating idea in this movement. I'm going to get to it in a minute, and I think it's wrong. Now, the other thinking was that, yes, although animals can suffer, and although they have minds, some sort of mind, they nevertheless, a being of higher faculties requires more to make him happy, capable of more acute suffering, certainly accessible to it at more points, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is the famous quote from Mill: it's better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig dissatisfied. I don't know how true that is, but in any event, that's the sort of thinking. So although you have this idea that animals matter and their suffering matters, okay, killing them doesn't matter because they don't have an interest in continuing to live. They're not self-aware. So as long as we treat them well and as long as we kill them in a relatively painless way, we don't harm them. There was born the animal welfare movement. That was the beginning of the idea that it's okay for us to kill and use animals as long as we treat them humanely. And within a matter of 100 years, you had laws in England, the United States. I mean, it's interesting in the history of ideas. There is, I'm not a historian of ideas, but what little I do know about the history of ideas, I think I can say safely that there's no other instance where human thinking changed so dramatically and so quickly, where you enter the 19th century with people thinking that animals don't matter at all. You leave the 19th century and enter the 20th century with basically many places in the Western world. Eastern thinking was different because they were, because of Hinduism and Jain Dharma, there was always different sorts of thing. Buddhism, there was different sorts of thinking in the East. But as far as the West is concerned, you have everywhere in the West basically having some form of animal welfare legislation prohibiting the infliction of unnecessary suffering and requiring the humane treatment of animals. Okay, and I would say that's our conventional wisdom. That's what 95% of the people on planet Earth believe. It's okay to use them, but we have a moral obligation to treat them humanely. I would also say, I hear people sometimes say to me, well, our ideology of using animals is invisible. It's an invisible ideology. I don't think there's anything invisible about it at all. It's very much out on the table. It's animal welfare. It's the idea that we have had for a couple hundred years now that they matter morally, but they're different from us. Their minds are different. They don't care that we use them. They just care about being treated well, and it's okay for us to use them as long as we treat them humanely and don't inflict unnecessary suffering on them. Now, that is the dominant ideology of what we call the modern animal movement. Okay? The difference is animal advocates think we need to do a lot more to stop inflicting unnecessary suffering and to satisfy the moral obligation of humane treatment. But it's a quantitative, not a qualitative distinction. The modern animal movement buys into this welfarist ideology. Here is a quote from Peter Singer. Now, Peter Singer is characterized as the father of the animal rights movement. So he's not an insignificant player in the scene. And he says, while self-awareness, the capacity to think ahead and have hopes and aspirations for the future, capacity for meaningful relations with others and so on, they're not relevant. Those characteristics are not relevant to the infliction of pain, but they are relevant to the question of taking life. It is not arbitrary to hold that the life of a self-aware being capable of abstract thought, planning for the future, complex acts of communication, and so forth, is more valuable than the life of a being without these capacities. Okay? So here you have the father of the animal rights movement saying, cognition is not really relevant to suffering, but cognition is relevant to the value of your life. That is straight out of Bentham. I mean, that's no different. That's Bentham a couple hundred years later, basically. It's all it is. An animal may struggle against a threat to its life, even if it cannot grasp that it has a life, in the sense, I really hate when people use it. in the sense that it requires an understanding of what it is to exist over a period of time, but in the absence of some form of mental continuity, it's not easy to explain why the loss to the animal killed is not, from an impartial point of view, made good by the creation of a new animal who will lead an equally pleasant life. If the infliction of suffering is what we're concerned about, rather than killing, I can imagine a world in which people eat mostly plant foods, but occasionally treat themselves to the luxury of free-range eggs, possibly even meat under conditions, meat from animals who live good lives under conditions natural for their species and are then humanely killed on the farm. Again, Peter Singer, father of the animal rights movement. You could say it's wrong to kill a being whenever a being is sentient or conscious, which I maintain. Then you could say that it's just as wrong to kill a chicken or a mouse as it is to kill you or me. I can't accept that idea. It may be just as wrong, but millions of chickens are killed every day. I can't think of that as a tragedy on the same scale as millions of humans being killed. Well, if you're a chicken, you do. And what is different about human beings? Humans are forward-looking. They have hopes and desires for the future. That seems a plausible answer to the question of why it's so tragic when humans die. This guy is the father of the animal rights movement, showing that the sexism of our society once again is demonstrated. You don't have to do a hell of a lot to be a father. But in any event, and also look. Don't get me wrong, I actually like Peter. I just disagree with him strongly. I really do. The Great Ape Project, okay, which Singer started in 1992. I actually have a chapter in that book. Peter Singer talks about, great apes. Why? They matter more because cognitively they are more like us, okay? Why? I just wrote an article that was published in a journal called The Point out of the University of Chicago, in which I talked about the reaction, how people are very angry with PETA because PETA kills a large number of the animals that they take in at their Norfolk facility. And what I argued was basically, look, I disagree with that. I think it's terrible. But in a way, what's PETA doing that's any different from their, and PETA's just sort of employing this way of thinking. I'm sure, I don't know, but I'm sure that the people at PETA are killing those animals in the best way that they possibly can, in the least painful way, the least distressful way that they possibly can. So, if you believe that animals don't have, that they don't lose anything when you kill them, that they don't like to suffer, they don't like to experience pain, they don't like to experience distress, but they, if you kill them painlessly, there's nothing wrong. They've lost nothing because they don't have a sense of their lives. If you believe that, if you believe what Singer says, what Peter's doing, there's nothing wrong with it. Absolutely nothing wrong with it, okay? And interestingly, even Tom Reagan, again, whom I have a great deal of affection for but disagree with on this particular issue, Tom Reagan, in the case for animal rights, has this, his theory is very different from Peter's, but then when he gets to the dog and the like, he's got a hypothetical. He said, what do you do if you got a human and a dog on a lifeboat? And then he says, what do you do if you got a human and a million dogs on the lifeboat and you got to get rid of either the human or the million dogs? You have to throw the million dogs off because out of the boat because humans have a greater capacity for satisfaction than dogs do. So death is a greater harm to the one human than it is to any one of the dogs. So you have to throw the dogs over. Now again, I live with 5 rescued dogs. I watch them. I watch them all the time, actually. And I think it's a toss-up. I think that they have many more opportunities for satisfaction than I do. But again, it's this idea that but the thing is that it's this idea that their minds are different from ours, and therefore their lives matter less. And I think that that's just plain wrong. And an important part of my philosophy that I've been developing over for 25 years now, and I have to tell you, I haven't seen Alex Hirschhaft in 15 years. And you know what? He's testament to a vegan diet. He doesn't look any older than he did than he did 15 years ago. But go vegan. Anyway, so my view is that if animals are sentient, they are self-aware. They are that They are self-aware, and that if animals are sentient, that is, if they are perceptually aware, that's all I mean by sentient. They are perceptual, they have subjective experiences, okay? They're able to experience pain, but that's really not all it is. It's that they're subjectively aware. They have subjective experiences. If a being has subjective experiences, then that being is by definition self-aware, has an interest in continuing to live, and we cannot morally justify treating that animal as a resource. I mean, to say that an animal that is sentient has no interest in continuing to live is like saying a being that has eyes has no interest in continuing to see. It's absolutely ridiculous, okay? Don Griffin, who's now passed away, who's a really terrific fellow, and probably one of the most important cognitive ethologists in the 20th century, makes the point that if animals are conscious of anything, the animal's own body and its own actions must fall within the scope of perceptual consciousness. We nevertheless deny animal self-awareness because we maintain they cannot think such thoughts as, it is I who am running or climbing this tree or chasing that moth. Griffin maintains when an animal consciously perceives the running, climbing, or moth chasing of another animal, it must be aware of who is doing these things. And if the animal is perceptually conscious of its own body, it is difficult to rule out similar recognition that it itself is doing the running, climbing, or chasing. Griffin concludes, if animals are capable of perceptual awareness, denying them some level of self-awareness would seem to be an arbitrary and unjustified restriction. I could not agree more with that statement. And my view is that if you require that animals have human-like self-awareness, that they be able, I actually debated Singer some years ago at a medical school, and he used it, you know, he said, animals, you know, we can recognize ourselves in a mirror. Well, okay, fine, we can recognize ourselves in a mirror, and you know, I have dogs that, you know, I can take my dogs for a walk, and you know, they can pee on a bush, and then they can come back 3 months later, and they can tell that they peed on that bush. I can't do that. I've tried it. It doesn't work. I can't. So you know, I mean, we are aware of ourselves the way we are aware as animals, and they are aware of themselves as they are. But the idea that in order for their lives to count, they've got to have human-like self-awareness is, in my judgment, ridiculous. Think about people who have transient global amnesia, which is very interesting. I've actually met some of these people. They're people who basically have no sense of the past and no sense of the future. They're stuck in an eternal present, which is basically the way Singer thinks most animals live, you know, that they live in this eternal present, no sense of the future, no sense of the past. I think that that's wrong, actually. But even if it were true, you know, is having transient global amnesia morally relevant? And the answer is maybe. If the question is, you're going to hire a history professor, do you hire somebody who's got transient global amnesia or somebody who doesn't? The answer is you probably are better off hiring the person who doesn't have transient global amnesia. But if the issue is, who do you take? You know, who do you kill? Who do you subject to a painful biomedical experiment, unconsenting subject of a biomedical experiment? The answer is, they both have a sense of themselves, the person with amnesia, the person without amnesia. They both have the sense of themselves. You can't justify using either of them. Okay. Man, this is hard. It's hard to encapsulate 25 years in 40 minutes. That's why I had to negotiate with this guy. You see, 12 minutes. I said, yeah, 12 minutes. 12 minutes, sure. Okay. So, I maintain that the modern animal movement goes in the entirely wrong direction by saying that it's just a matter of how we use them now, not that we use them. And I maintain that the movement we could not have the movement we have now if people didn't accept on some level this Singer business, this Bentham business, that animal life per se doesn't matter. Because, you know, I was talking with somebody a couple days ago who said, well, you know, I think the reason why we have to have these welfare campaigns is because animal exploitation is so pervasive that it's okay for us to talk about, you know, compassionate use or humane use. I said, let me give you an example in the human context. Let's take rape. Now, obviously, rape is not numerically as significant as animal exploitation simply because we exploit more animals than humans that exist on the planet at any given time. But rape is a serious problem. In 2013, it's still a hideous problem. One out of four women who make it through college, one out of four, and that's the numbers we know about, so you got to figure it's worse. One out of four women will be a victim of a rape or attempted rape. I mean, the violence against women in this world of ours, in this country, in this so-called civilized country of ours, is abominable. Now, so if you say, well, look, you know, you got to do something to help these women now. Let's have humane rape campaigns. Nobody, no, I don't mean that to be humorous. I think that nobody would think that that's a good idea. But we say, well, animal exploitation is pervasive, so let's have regulation of animal exploitation. The only way that could make sense to you is if you think animals matter less than we do. And in my judgment, that's a negation of the fundamental concept of animal rights. Okay. Now we're gonna get to the controversial part. Look, I think you can't justify animal use, period. You just can't. Theoretically, for the reasons I just gave you. But I also think, as a practical matter, I would call animal welfare regulation a disaster, but it is an insult to disasters to call it such. I think that the whole animal welfare movement is, I mean, it doesn't work. As a matter of fact, let me get the second. This is to say a being who's not sentient has no interest in continuing to live. This is just a poster that was on my Facebook site. All right, animal welfare does not work. That's the second thing. There, how's that for a graphic? Wrong way. Animal welfare reforms are not baby steps. They are big steps in a backward direction. All right. We're hearing about, cage-free eggs, free-range eggs, enriched cages. This is the big thing these days. And the animal movement is cage-free, free-range, enriched cages. That's cage-free. Okay? That's cage-free. You want to fight? If that's what the revolution is about, the revolution, sisters and brothers, is dead. Okay? If that's what we're fighting for, then I strongly suggest we're going in the wrong direction. That's cage-free. That's what we're fighting for? That's free range. That's an FDA photo. At least that's what was represented to me on the net, and it must be true because it was on the internet. But that's free range. That's an enriched cage, okay? That's a building of enriched cages. Now, I do not think that this sort of thing represents any significant increase of protection of animal interests. Absolutely not, okay? Here's a chart, free-range hens, battery cage hens. They're both the beak. There's forced moultings. They're violently packed into trucks. They're denied the opportunity to live a natural life, and the males are killed in both situations. That's a chart from a sanctuary that advocates veganism. So basically, I don't think that animal welfare reforms do anything to significantly increase animal protection. That's from the PETA website. It was about their campaign, because people always say to me, well, we have to do something to help animals now. And the answer is, really? Okay. Most of these welfare reforms don't take effect, for 3,000 years. They'll be phased in over the next, 3,000 years. This is an example of what I regard as the problem. You have PETA has a campaign against Burger King. And in 2001, PETA says, it's done. We've won. They're going to get some number of animals are going to come. Some of their pigs are going to come from non-gestation crates. Some of their eggs are going to come from non-battery cages. We've won. 7 years later, they're saying they still haven't done it. And we've won this time because we've negotiated. And now they say they're going to do it. This is the sort of thing we're talking about. Whether it's Burger King or these other campaigns, this idea that animal welfare reforms do something now, first of all, I don't think they do anything. But they certainly don't do anything now. So this idea that, well, this is what we need to do to help animals now, I think is sort of silly. There's this idea, unfortunately, you're not going to be able to see this too well, but that's okay because I got to go through this quickly. There is this idea that animal welfare reforms will lead incrementally to not using animals. And some of my friends who promote this stuff, they say to me, but Gary, you don't understand. If we have welfare reforms, it's going to make animal products more expensive and people will eat fewer animal products. I got news for you. It doesn't work that way. There's something that gets in the way of that scenario. It's called economics. Animals are chattel property. They have no value except as things. They have their chattel property. They have no value other than the value that we give them, okay? And if you look, as I have, I mean, a good chunk of my career has been focusing on animal welfare reforms. If you look at the history of the animal welfare movement, what you see is not reforms which increase the price of animal products. You actually see reforms which make animal exploitation more economically efficient. Look at the Humane Slaughter Act of 1958. I must say, I was alive when that was passed. The Humane Slaughter Act of 1958 required that large animals be stunned before they're shackled and hoisted. Okay? Didn't apply to chickens. We'll get to that in a second. Why did that pass? Go and read the legislative history. Because animals that are conscious, that are hanging upside down when they weigh 2,000 pounds, move around a lot. And you know what happens? They hit workers. You know what happens when workers get hit? You have workers' compensation suits, or you have lawsuits, and you have carcass damage. So it was economically the right thing to do. It actually increased production efficiency. Now, chickens weren't included in the Humane Slaughter Act of 1958. Why? Because people said, well, you know, chickens, I mean, you know, what the hell? I mean, they're hanging upside down. What are they going to, you know, they're little. They can't injure workers. They can't incur carcass damage. Point wrong. So now we have a campaign for controlled atmosphere killing or gassing chickens. And that's from the HSUS report. Anybody who wants that, I'll be happy to give you the site. And all this stuff's out of my book, The Animal Rights Debate, anyway. All the sites are there. That's an HSUS report that basically says stunning chickens is economically better for, if you were going to start a chicken slaughterhouse tomorrow, you'd be insane not to use controlled atmosphere killing because it's a lot cheaper. You cut down on carcass damage dramatically, and there are lots of worker injuries using the method that they use now, which involves an electrified bath and a knife. There are still lots of worker injuries. You get rid of that with controlled atmosphere killing. This is from a PETA report on controlled atmosphere killing. Controlled atmosphere killing has the double advantage of offering the industry an opportunity to boost welfare and cut costs at the same time. And again, I've got the sites for those full reports. If you read them, they discuss at great length how controlled atmosphere killing is economically more efficient. Same thing with just the gestation crate. Gestation crates actually cut down on production costs. This is a Compassion and World Farming summary report, basically, which says that animal welfare reforms can make the industry more efficient. This is not, people, this is not getting animals away from the property paradigm. It's further enmeshing them in the property paradigm. All it's doing is making animal exploitation more efficient. We had this campaign that people were very excited about. Peter Singer was excited about it. It was a PETA campaign to get McDonald's to adopt Temple Grandin's slaughter methods, to buy from producers that killed with Temple Grandin's slaughter methods. This is from Temple Grandin. Once livestock arrive at the plants, procedures are important not only for the animal's well-being, they can also mean the difference between profit and loss. Research demonstrates that meat quality benefits can be obtained with careful, quiet animal handling. Properly handled animals are not only an important ethical goal, they keep the meat industry running safely, efficiently, profitably. Same thing, that's just another thing about how humane treatment can result in better bottom line. That's a McDonald's statement basically saying that animal welfare is important not only for the animals, but it's important, again, for the bottom line. Again, this is not moving, this is not progress, people. All this is efficient exploitation. This is just making the whole process of exploitation more economically efficient. It's not moving us away from it psychologically, and it's not moving us away from it economically, And it's not causing us to consume fewer animal products because of demand going down because the price is going up. This is something I got yesterday at the university. Somebody sent me this thing about Jonathan Ford could come to my class. You know, it wasn't to me, it was to professors generally. You know, that you could have Jonathan Safran Foer come to your class as a result of Farm Forward. You know, they would sponsor him. And Farm Forward is basically saying, we exist to help the producers of animal products increase their profitability. By being more humane, we'll show you how being more humane can actually increase your bottom line. Okay? And now you might say, Oh man, 5 minutes, you're kidding me. You're kidding me. Can we negotiate 10? 10, let's negotiate 10. Okay, 10. Come on, 10. Can I have 10? All right. We'll see whether he's really into this populist thing like he says he is. Okay. And by the way, there's a quote there praising this organization from my friend Bruce Friedrich. Bruce, are you here? Yeah, Bruce. Is that a correct quote? Okay, well, in any event. Some of you might say, hey, look, if these things are economically efficient, why hasn't industry figured out to do them? And the answer is, it's a good question, and it's an easy answer. Factory farming started in the 1950s. People thought, well, you know, you got 10 animals in a barn, you're making $10 profit. You put 100 animals in the same space, you make $100 profit. Nobody factored in the fact that when you increase the space concentration like that, you would have stress, you would have illness, you would have all sorts of problems. It's only now in the 21st century that we're starting to find out what the inefficiencies of modern animal agriculture are. And what's happening is you have animal groups working with industry trying to identify the economically inefficient practices, whether it's tethering calves in veal crates, or whether it's the gestation crate. All of these things are economically efficient. Alternatives will actually increase the bottom line. I saw people were excited. I saw something that Farm Sanctuary put out about some study in the Journal of Agricultural Economics that said that consumption goes down when you have animal welfare reform. Anybody wants to discuss that with me? I mean, I've read that study, and it absolutely doesn't say that. It doesn't say that at all. But there's absolutely no proof that animal welfare reform is reducing consumption of animal products. There is a huge disadvantage in having this approach, and that is we have labels. This is the ASPCA, HSUS, the Certified Humane Raised and Handled label. On corpses, you can go and you can buy meat that has Certified Humane raised and handled labels, okay? And that's a product of the HSUS, ASPCA, other organizations. This is Humane Choice, which is Humane Society International. They tell you that animals that have, you can't see it, but you can, if you want to come up and look at it really closely, you will see that they're saying that animals that have this label live a life as close to as they can to old McDonald's farm. This is HSUS saying this. This is a bag from Whole Foods. Chicks dig cage-free eggs. This is problematic on different levels, actually. I feel so audience-friendly. I actually brought a bag. This says, well done. When it's raised right, it tastes right. Beef, pork, chicken, turkey. Look for the 5-step animal welfare ratings to know the animals you were raised raised for meat that you were buying were well treated. This is a sign that was outside a Whole Foods. Whole organic chicken on sale that Friday for $1.99 a pound. Can you imagine someone's life costs $1.99 a pound? Animal welfare rating step 2. Okay? Now, my friend, whom I've known for many years and like very much, Wayne Pacell, sits on the board of that animal welfare rating program. But before we get too excited about HSUS, this is a letter that was sent by Peter Singer to John Mackey expressing his appreciation and support for the Happy Meat program being developed by Whole Foods. Now, the other thing I'm going to show you is, watch this. Look at that. Look, laser. Okay. Who signed on there? Not just HSUS, but Vegan Outreach, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, Mercy for Animals. Okay? The idea that this is not sending a message to the public that it's okay to eat this stuff, I'm sorry, is crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And, you know, and my friend Bruce Friedrich and I had a recent internet debate. I'm sure we'll continue that this morning, actually. And Bruce said, yeah, but Amnesty International, they are against political imprisonment, but they work to stop torture. At the same time, you know, I mean, they're working to make it better for the prisoners. The answer is, yeah, but you know what? Amnesty International doesn't give awards to dictators. And that's a fundamental distinction. And so when you have my friends, and I spent a lot of my youth, people, a lot of my youth was spent at People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, where I met Dr. Hirschhaft, and where I met a lot of the people who are in this room. But I spent a lot of time with PETA. I have a lot of affection for Ingrid and for Alex Pacheco, who used to run PETA with her. A lot of affection. I think this is obscene. The idea that you give an award to Whole Foods, the idea that you send a message to the public that this sort of thing is a good thing, you know, that the five-step animal welfare program, and to say that people aren't hearing it that way is nonsense. You can't possibly give somebody an award. That's an award they gave to Temple Grandin. PETA gave an award to Temple Grandin. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be critical of them, but I disagree with that very strongly. You cannot do this sort of thing without sending out a normative message that consumption of happy meat is okay. There is, I just tell you parenthetically a quick story. Yesterday was a big day for me. I also got an email from some group that's all upset about HSUS. Because HSUS apparently has a pig farmer on the board of directors or something like that. I don't know, so they employ some pig farmer. And I said to my partner, Anna, I said, you know, I said, sort of funny. I said, people are all appalled at this as if it's something new. And I thought back 25 years ago, like I was like about to enter middle age, and I was, I mean, you know, but 25 years ago, there was an issue where Fund for Animals, which no longer exists because it was acquired by HSUS, we have mergers and acquisitions in the animal movement now, but Fund for Animals had a sanctuary in Texas, and it was being run by a guy who had a pig operation on the side, and animals that were at the Black Beauty Ranch, animals at the Black Beauty Ranch were being bred with other animals, and those animals were being taken to slaughter in Fund for Animals trucks, and it was a big scandal. And the Village Voice, before it became a horrible newspaper, the Village Voice in Manhattan wrote an article about it, and I was critical of Fund for Animals, and I got yelled at 25 years. I've been getting yelled at consistently for years now by the animal movement that gets upset when I point out these hypocrisies. But I'm sorry, people. You know, this is wrong. This is wrong. I don't question the good faith of the people who are doing this, but I just think as a strategic matter, as a moral matter, it's just dead wrong. So what's the solution? What's the solution? The solution is making clear that veganism is the moral baseline. That if animals matter at all, we cannot justify eating them, wearing them, using them. I can't stand meatless Monday, go veg, go vegan, go vegetarian, go vegan before six. Bullshit. As far as I am concerned, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be speciesist when it comes to bulls. But the bottom line is, you know, this idea that we promote that there's a distinction between meat and other animal products is nonsense. It's absolute nonsense, okay? There's as much suffering in a pound of steak as there is in a glass of milk. They're equal. I mean, as far as I, the idea that we tell people That they ought to go vegetarian is, as far as I'm concerned, outrageous. We ought to be clear. Veganism. If you care, if animals matter, you can't justify eating them, wearing them, using them, period. I don't want to hear about compassionate consumption. I don't want to hear about being a conscientious omnivore. I just don't buy that stuff. I think it's ridiculous. I think it's morally obscene. My view is that if you deliver the message to somebody and they say, I'm not ready to go vegan, that's fine. Let them take whatever step short of veganism they want to take. We should never be in a position of telling them that doing less than veganism is an all right thing to do morally. And you know what? Before someone says, I will finish. I'm finishing. I got 2 minutes. Before somebody says, yeah, but what? But we won't get these animal welfare reforms for whatever little they do, we won't get them. The answer is, of course you would. If we had a strong vegan movement, what do you think? Industry would do nothing? They would respond with the same minor improvements, as it were, that would make their exploitation more efficient. I'm tired of this idea that we can't confront the fact that people should go vegan. Just released this week as an ebook, a book that I wrote with my partner Anna, called Eat Like You Care, An Examination of the Morality of Eating Animals. Basically, he takes the position, if you think what Michael Vick did was wrong, then whether you realize it or not, you're committed to veganism. I am tired of this idea, which I only encounter from animal advocates, not from the general public, that talking about veganism is too radical. I got news for you, people. It's not radical at all. It's not radical at all. People get this. The people who have the biggest problem with it are people, ironically, in the animal movement. I want to finish up with an important point of the abolitionist approach is the relationship between human rights and animal rights. People say to me, are they really the same? You know, I mean, do you really have to connect them? Why are you so left-wing? Why are you so, you know, the answer is, look, left-wing, right-wing, you know, the bottom line is, I believe in human rights. My view is quite simple. We object to speciesism because, like racism, sexism, heterosexism, classism, ableism, it focuses on a morally irrelevant criterion and excludes others from the moral community. So that means we've got a position, whether you like it or not, we got a position on racism, sexism, heterosexism, classism, ableism, and other forms of discrimination. And the thing is, you can't take a position. If you take the position that you object to animal exploitation, but you don't have a position on racism, then you're just a misanthrope. You just don't like people, that's all. And that, you know, and I'm not interested in that scene at all. And I started, you know, I remember the first time I taught animal rights theory when I was teaching at the University of Pennsylvania in 1984, 85. And I talked about the relationship between sexism and speciesism. The bottom line is, not that it would be morally justified, but if you think that anyone's ever gone vegan because some woman wearing lettuce leaves on her breasts or not having lettuce leaves on her breasts gave them a veggie dog, you are out of your minds. I'm sorry. But the bottom line is, as long as we are treating women like pieces of meat, we're going to treat meat like pieces of meat. It's all the same. You can't get away from it. And if you're committed to animal rights, you're committed to human rights, whether you like it or not. Final point, I don't want to get him too upset with me. Although he's limited because, he, you know, probably people will take pictures if he got violent. I am totally opposed to violence. For those of you who know anything about my work, this is the book. You can get it on Amazon.com. Oh, yeah, eatlikeyoucarebook.com, and then it takes you to Amazon. Human rights, perfect. Okay, my last point, violence. I am violently opposed to violence. I mean, look, you want to solve, if violence solved the world's problems, we'd be living in the Garden of Eden right now, because the history of humankind is the history of violence. It hasn't worked. It's an abject failure. I'm opposed to it as a moral matter. I'm opposed to it as a spiritual matter. I'm deeply committed to ahimsa or the notion of nonviolence. However, even if you don't agree with me on that, I want to leave you with one thought about violence, about the irrationality of violence. And I will tell you a quick story about a woman came up to me at a talk I was giving in Canada. And she said, you say you believe in animal rights, but there's a vivisector at this university who's using 60 dogs a year. And you don't think it's acceptable, morally justifiable, to engage in violence against that person to stop him from killing the dogs. I said, no, I do not. I think it's wrong, and I think we got to stop it any nonviolent way that we can, but I think violence is wrong. And she said, how can you say that? I said, let me ask you a question. Are you a vegan? She said, yes. I said, your mother a vegan? No, but she doesn't eat beef, she said. I said, great. I said, what does she eat? She says, she eats chicken. I says, she eats chicken. How many times does she eat chicken a week? She said, I don't know. What relevance? I said, answer my question. How many times does she eat chicken? 2 or 3 times a week. I said, fine. She's responsible for more than 60 chicken deaths a year. Your mother is an animal exploiter. So if it's okay to do violence against the vivisector, it's okay to do violence against your mother. We live in a world in which 98% of the people engage in animal exploitation. To say that violence against animal exploiters is justified creates a, even if you don't agree morally with me, it creates a problem of mind-boggling proportions in terms of making it all make sense. Obviously, I've been trying to sort of get a lot of stuff out. And you know, I've been a vegan for 32 years now, and I bet you I got more energy than most of the kids I teach who are young enough to be my grandchildren. But I have to, you know, go to abolitionistapproach.com, my website. That's the Facebook thing. That's the Twitter site. And you can read more, and I'll try to answer questions. Okay? Thanks very much.
Check.